Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff, stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. So we just got here in time, didn't we?
We have literally just rushed to Stuttgart from...
You've forgotten already.
God, where were we? I forgot. Geneva. We were in Geneva and we've made it by the skin of our teeth. We've both frantically set up in our different hotel rooms because this is a fantastic, really, really exciting one.
It is. And we don't need, she doesn't need much of an introduction, you know, Sheryl Crow. I mean, we don't need to tell our listeners how amazing she is and what she's done and all the success and the Grammys and the millions and millions of records. But she has a fantastic film that's just come out, a documentary. Called Cheryl, which we've both been lucky enough to be able to watch.
Yeah, and it's brilliant. I've got various personal connections with her, certainly with her early days. So that's very nice for me. So I don't should probably go, who the hell are you?
By the way, I just wanted to tell you, I'm in the Who room. Do you know what the Who room is?
No.
5:15.
What's the Who? Oh.
Every time I get 5:15, I've had it a few times. I always think, you know, I can't stop singing the tune in my head.
No, well, of course, and I play it every night anyway, don't I? Arnold Lane.
Arnold, do you think Nick knows you play a licks from 5:15 in Arnold Lane?
I don't know. I don't know. And yes, he must do by now. I mean, it's on the album.
He's never frowned.
Anyway,
all right. I digress.
You do. We both digress. Okay. Anyway, let's get her on.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. It's
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Oh!
Hello.
Oh, lovely to see you.
How are you, Cheryl?
Nice to see you all.
You remember Guy. Guy's been worried you didn't remember him.
Guy, I remember you.
Oh, it's so nice to be remembered, Cheryl. It's been a very, very long time.
But we're still at it. We're still going.
Isn't it amazing? You, stronger than ever. Oh, my God.
Wow, thank you.
I watched your film. Amazing. And I've been listening to Threads. Oh, my God. You know, fantastic.
Yeah, your film
thank
really...
Proud of you, Cheryl.
Your film was incredible.
You grew up all...
we mentioned earlier to your PA that we're just arrived in a hotel. We're in Stuttgart. We've travelled from Geneva. We're on tour together. We play with Nick Mason from Pink Floyd.
Oh my gosh. Tell him I said hello.
I absolutely and will. So
I love that you're still doing that, guy.
I can't get away, Cheryl. Can't get away from it's kind of the family.
Love
it's
it.
Because I should, just for our listeners, point out that Cheryl and I met on the when the Michael Jackson and Pink Floyd tours were crisscrossing with each other in 88. And Greg and Cheryl became our sort of mascots. You two were hanging out together. You used to come and hang with us.
Greg Fillinggate.
Yes.
And then there was this lovely thing because Greg then ended up coming on tour with David Gilmour.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, which was lovely. And in fact, I sent him a message. I said I was going to be speaking to you because I was really moved to see him in your doco. And I sent him, I said, hey, have you got anything you'd like to say? And he just, I'm so grateful for the times I shared with Cheryl and Guy and that we're still in each other's lives to this day.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I speak with Greg frequently, probably more now than in years. And I'll tell you what, it's funny. I don't know about you, Guy, but as I get older, my relationships become so much more precious. And I don't know, I guess it's, you have a stronger sense of time and how short, how fast it's going and how short life is, and just staying connected, how important it is.
Yeah, my wife said to me the other day, don't make any new friends because we don't have time to see the ones we already have.
But That's true.
When she sees you talking to someone at a party, she pulls you away.
Yeah, That's right. You cannot make more friends.
Cheryl, I want to tell you this because we both, Guy and I, both finished the film this morning. And we came down to breakfast where we were and we both said exactly the same thing. Oh, my God, the bit with the children, I cried.
Yeah, we both cried.
And I felt it. I mean, I just welled up so strongly because I've been away now for 7 weeks with Guy and Nick, and we've got 2 more weeks left, and I've got a 10-year-old, I've got a 13-year-old, I've got older kids. I miss them so much. It's the hardest thing about being on tour.
It is. I mean, I'm very lucky. You know, I've been able to take my kids on the road from the very beginning. I mean, my Wyatt, who's 15 now, has been on a tour bus since he was, you know, 6 months old. And Levi, because I didn't know Levi was coming, 2 weeks later, he was in a crib on a bus. He's being passed around in this communal environment. And I've not ever shared my kids on social media. I've always been sort of abjectly opposed to that. Mm-hmm. So to be able to put them in the documentary, because they are the most important part of my story, to put them in there, I mean, it felt really impactful. And I've watched the documentary twice. I watched it when they first did it, put it together, and then I went to the premiere. And I boo-hoo. It's very sentimental for me. And I've had that reaction from a lot of people. It's really struck a lot of people, so...
Especially as you're already utilizing at least one as a tech to bring you your
both of them. You were out with Phil Collins, right? A couple of years ago, before the pandemic, we went out with Phil Collins, and you know he's huge, and we're playing these giant soccer stadiums, like 80,000 people. And I told the boys, since they're older now, if you guys help tech and you bring out guitars, you help tune and stuff, I'll pay you per show. $5 a show. That's pretty good. $5 a show?
Brilliant.
I don't know where you were. You got to get help where you can. we're taking a bow at the end of a show somewhere, and my kids come out, and as we're walking off, my then 10-year-old says, "Mom, can we negotiate a flat fee, get our money up front, as opposed to having to wait to the end of the summer?" I'm just like, "What, are you an accountant?"
But it's great.
Crazy.
It's great you take.
They're very savvy.
That little bit of home that comes with you is so important because the guitar player.
We had a dog. You took a dog.
Yeah,
on
that's what I was going to say. Because the guitarist in the band.
Gary.
Doesn't have children. He's in love with his dog and misses his dog so much. Eric, who's named after Eric Clapton, by the way. And he welled up at the bit with the dog because that you took your dog on the road.
We feel that way about our dogs. I mean, we have really been tossing around the idea of bringing our dogs on the bus, but, you know, can't do it.
Well, or you could go the whole hog and do the tour on horseback. Just take the horses as well.
That's really, just for the environmental look would be great. Well, there's not use any gas, just have the whole thing, horse and buggies and carts and, you know.
It's Cheryl, it's tricky doing the choosing the moment to say, now I'm going to do the documentary about my past. When you're an artist that is always pushing forward and making new art, what made you think now is the time, and was it the director that convinced you to go with her?
Well, there are a couple of things. I really didn't want to do a documentary, but my manager, who's obviously in the documentary, has been with me from the beginning, was really encouraging of it. He said, look, we've had a lot of people reach out. Obviously documentaries are very popular right now, and that was one of the reasons I didn't want to do it. But he said, you know, you have a lot of interest, and the fact that you've been around for so many years. I mean, that the fact that, you know, I had a whole life before I ever got my record deal. My first album didn't come out till I was 29.
Yeah.
It seemed like a good time to do it. Plus we were all in a pandemic, so there wasn't anything else going on. But I don't think I really understood how emotional it was going to be to sit for hours on end and not just remember, but reflect, like to revisit some of these hard stories. And you know, it's not like you just tell the stories, you know, you really put yourself back in it. So it was, I mean, in the end, it's been really good because I'm a very private person and I've not ever told the whole story. And a lot of it is still on the cutting room floor. But to be able to just do it in my own terms and tell the stories and then be done with it, and have people, you know, I mean, it's all there. It's all out there.
But isn't it amazing? Must have been an amazing thing for you to, because then you can actually see the path of your life. Because actually Joe Walsh, who features in it quite heavily, fabulously.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him interviewed in something once. He made this brilliant point. He said that someone had once said that a life as you live it seems like this completely mad random set of events that you stagger from one thing to the other. So but then you get to the end of it and look back, not saying we're at the end of it, but when you get to a point of it and look back, it looks like the most perfectly crafted novel.
Yeah, you know, people will say, do you have any regrets? And I look at it and go, oh no. I mean, I feel like everything brought about the next thing and the next thing. And I learned from doing the wrong thing here, and that's why the right thing happened here. And
yeah,
I mean, it is so true. I just don't know if there's ever a point in your life when you actually sit down and force yourself to remember everything. I mean, so much of it, obviously I'm older now, you forget so much of it, you know, and there's never a reason to actually sit down and remember things. And this was really an exercise in digging around in the in the caverns of my memory banks, and I mean, I would be on the couch at 8 o'clock at night sound asleep, just exhausted. Because it's hard. It's really hard work to actually sit and think and remember.
I think what comes across in the documentary for me, and I watch a lot of rock documentaries, we all do, but the bits that are we all connect to, not just as me as someone who's in the same business as you, but people who are out in all other kinds of jobs, are the bits when life gets really tough. And your story has some really tough moments in it that you have to face that are universal. And how you approach those and how you push through those is a lesson for us. And that's why we're watching the documentary. And that's what I got from the documentary.
I mean, I do love hearing you say that. I do feel like, you know, even though my life has revolved around music, particularly as a woman, there are themes in it that apply to everybody. I mean, I know genetically that my mental health, I come by it honestly, and a lot of us do. But I also know that the pressure of life can throw you into really challenging moments where you can't find your way out. And particularly now with what we're going through, not just
the
pandemic, but just everything. I mean, everything is harder now. And there's no handbook. There's no like, okay, this is what you do when you can't find your way out. Read this chapter. And there is none of that. You just have to figure out, you have to feel your way through it. And And as a woman and having being in a business that's run by men for the most part, which is true in corporations, it's not just in the entertainment world, to navigate the sexual, challenges. I mean, it's not all sexual harassment, but we're at a moment now where at least we're being taken seriously when we have these stories. But, you know, 30 years ago, there was none of that. I mean, you were vilified. And then, you know, for me now, being in a business that's revolved around being looking perfect, you know, having the big lips as opposed to the wrinkled lips, you know, it's you enter as a woman, you enter an ageist moment, you know, and all of these things are the reality of life and of living, no matter what your line of work is. It's amplified when you're in a line of work where you're in the public eye, obviously, but it's navigating how to handle knowing yourself well enough to know what you will do and what you won't do, and then having to be okay with that.
Yeah.
I also like, especially in the light of what's just happened in America, which is just shocking.
It's like,
looking back, like at how politically powerful, say, the Lilith Fair was.
Yes.
Yes.
That's, you know. That's, yeah. I mean, were you aware of that at the time? Was, you know, because look at it now. It's like, it's
pretty, explain what the Lilith Fair was.
It was
an act of defiance. I mean, honestly, I remember the day that Sarah McLachlan called me, and, you know, there weren't cell phones or texting, and she actually called me up and said, "I'm very tired of hearing promoters say we can't have more than one woman on a bill." Yeah. I can remember there was an artist, a female artist I wanted to bring out with me. And I mean, I was cut off at the knees by a promoter saying, an agent saying, "You won't sell tickets. People don't want to come see, you know, men won't buy tickets to a bill that only has women on it." And that just absolutely was dumbfounding. And so when Sarah had this idea, she's like, "Will you share the bill? Will you do the whole tour?" And I was absolutely unequivocally on board. And then from that moment on, it felt like an act of defiance. It felt like a call, you know, a call to action. And then it felt like a total celebration, sort of a grand fuck you, if you will. And I think no one had any idea what the tentacles of that would look like. I mean, you talk to young artists like Brandi Carlile who say, "I was in the audience."
Yeah.
That was the moment where I was like, okay, I'm a young gay woman, but I can do this, and I can sell tickets to other gay people, but families also, men.
Yeah.
I mean, music is not relegated to just one demographic. It is a heart thing.
Yeah. That's interesting you say that, because, you know, when a male singer-songwriter releases an album, he's apparently speaking to young people everywhere. When a female artist releases, a singer-songwriter releases, she's speaking to young girls everywhere. It's like, why? What?
Hang on.
Your music, your lyrics. I mean, I remember, you know, when one of your tracks came out, I'm driving up onto Santa Monica Boulevard, and K-Rock was playing, and I hear that lyric straight coming out of the radio. All I want to do, coming out of the radio. Wow, this song's about me right now. You know, I didn't know who you were at the time. It was you were a new artist. But you see what I'm saying about that sort of implication?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I did an interview earlier today with a guy who's probably in his 40s or 50s. And he's like, "I was 19 when the Globe Sessions came out, and I felt like that whole album was written for me." And that's, I mean, as an artist, that's like the highest compliment, because for me, when I was a kid, I felt like every song that Elton and that James Taylor and Carole King, I mean, those were the singer-songwriters that gave me that tunnel out of my hometown and also out of myself and out of my reality. And, that's the whole thing. And I think, you know, people with the business mind that wear the business hats that try to market they can only see it one way. And it, that's not the reality of music. Music is about the intervals and about the the words and the melodic choices, and it's bigger, you know. And I think that Lilith was that moment that sort of illustrated that.
Yeah, I find it shocking that that was even a thing, and I feel guilty as a man that that had never occurred to me. I never knew there was a thing about you know, not having all women built.
Yeah, but that's the same as
also,
in
can I say, I mean, I hate to say this, that the thing we come up against, Cheryl, is that we invite, we are perceived as being a very, very male podcast. And Gary and I are really not toxic masculinity sort of people at all. And it's, we find it very hard to get women to come on our show.
Maybe because there's two guys.
Really?
Nice and friendly. Yeah. Because it's two guys. And it's understandable. That, and it's upsetting. You know.
That's crazy. Okay, that is just crazy. Okay,
things are changing.
That ends right now.
Well, I tell you,
that ends right now.
Yeah. Talking about
we need our Lilith.
No, stop
yes,
it.
You are,
in fact, yes.
You are our Lilith.
No,
I am the man. I am the man to your Lilith.
Yeah, exactly.
Cheryl, talking about people being in the audience whose lives got changed. I was talking to my wife earlier, and I was telling her about your documentary, and she went, "Was she that? Was she that girl on stage with Michael Jackson? I saw that show in when it came to London, and she changed everything for me. I wanted to be her. In fact, she was me on stage with Michael, and she had no idea it was Sheryl Crow.
Oh,
all these years.
My goodness. That is crazy. Do you know what I remember from that show? I remember being introduced to Peter Gabriel, which, I mean, I was still a total nobody, small town Missouri. And I get introduced to him, and I'm holding a Diet Coke. And as he's shaking my hand, I'm shaking both of my hands up and down, and Diet Coke is going everywhere. That's how I remember. And I also met Eric Clapton at those shows. Those shows, we did several nights at Wembley, and and Greg Fillinganes introduced me to Eric Clapton at one of those shows. So, yeah. You know,
how was it working with Michael Jackson?
All kinds of full circle.
How was it working with Michael?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, for a number of reasons, it was incredible. For one thing, I grew up on his music. I owned all the Jackson 5. My first album that I got from Santa Claus was ABC. I'd never even been out of my own country. I had to get a passport to actually go on that tour. And to see the world that way was incredible. But not just that, but to be in a, what was, you know, ostensibly was a traveling circus. It was just like all these people from every walk of life traveling together and seeing the world, backing up arguably the most famous artist of our time, was incredible and life-changing. But then you also had the other kind of oddity spectacle of it. You know, he wasn't just any artist. And by the time I came off of that tour, I had been connected with him romantically, which was clearly probably the device of his promotion team. But my life was changed personally from that as well.
Yeah, it comes out in them too.
You know, I have a funny memory, Cheryl. I have a funny memory. I don't remember where it was because we bumped into you. It was in Paris and in Dallas and various places. But I remember you and Greg coming.
We were at Bandouche together, Guy. I don't know if you remember that.
That's
in Paris.
Yes.
I do remember that.
Yes.
Yeah. I've got some very nice pictures of you, actually, in a little brasserie in Paris.
Oh, that's amazing. And,
sorry, Guy, you keep photographs of Cheryl in a brasserie. What brasserie do you keep them in? So strange.
Well, wouldn't you?
No, it's
But I remember we were in a hotel room somewhere, and it was, lots of us. It was a kind of party night. I think it might have been Gary Wallace's room. And you and Greg and I were sitting up against the wall.
And Scooter.
David called down.
Scooter was there also.
Oh, yeah, Scooter was,
But, and David Gilmore
called down to see where the party was. And it was like, well, Gary said, oh, it's in my room. So David came to hang out in the room. And I remember you and Greg just looking like absolute stuff, because this was the equivalent of Michael coming to one of your rooms.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And you know what else is funny? And I don't know if you remember this, but we'd been in there for a good 30, 45 minutes. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a cupboard or a closet door opens and Nick Mason just falls out.
What?
Do you remember that? He'd been in there. And then the door swings open and he just falls straight out.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Not, I mean, we that sounds more like something I would do. Absolutely ask him about that moment.
Something that comes over in the documentary about the Jackson tour, obviously, is your sort of first experience of the darker side of being a woman in this male world, which is you end up in with sexual harassment from Michael's manager. I mean, was there a sense of like, I can't carry on in this business? How am I? You know, you never wanted to get out at that point?
Yeah, I think the whole thing culminated on Thanksgiving Day in Australia. I mean, I remember exactly where I was. I remember, you know, in America, we eat turkey. We were eating emu, if you can imagine. We're all sitting around in this giant hall.
They have turkeys in Australia.
I know. I think that was one of the things that was offered, but I don't know why. You know, it's weird what sticks out in your memory banks. But But I remember being in this big hall and Frank coming over and pointing at me and said, remember this moment, you'll never have it again. And,
wow,
you know, it was such a cliche. And no one on the tour knew what had been going on. After he left, I remember being in a side room with a couple of the backup singers and explaining to them what I'd been through. And that was the day that it had come out all over the tabloids that Michael Jackson's manager had been fired for supposedly managing the backup singer. And I hadn't gone public. No one had that I knew of. And he had signed an exclusivity contract with Michael. So it was a very dark time, and it made me lose faith in the whole thing. I didn't realize there were so many machinations that went into somebody being huge at radio, you know, that there was payola, that there was a mob, like in some instances, history of getting corporations to buy singles and driving the songs up the charts. I mean, it was just, it was very unsavory. And when I went home, I did feel like, okay, he's going to make it impossible for me ever to work again, especially after having gone to an attorney and gotten and getting no help.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the rock on tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out.
Can we talk about the little group of musicians that I know Guy knows that you ended up on this Tuesday night club playing yes. with? Because some of those you had some connection. Did you not sing on Cheryl's first album, Guy?
I did. I'm uncredited on the Na Na song, the Sha Na Na song.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I came to a couple of the Tuesday nights because, of course, you know, remember, because I, for those who don't know, the Tuesday Night Music Club kind of grew out of Toy Matinee, right? The band which I was in.
Right.
I did the
Right. But,
yes, so I came to a couple of those Tuesday nights. And I remember, the funny thing, if I listen to the album, I can hear myself.
Oh my gosh,
I remember
Guy,
doing
I cannot
it.
Believe.
Don't worry, I'm not hassling you for a credit. Don't worry.
That is crazy. Well, you are credited then. You are credited, yeah.
No, I'm not credited. I don't
know that I remember that, but okay. I will say in my defense.
Well, no, I spoke to Brian McLeod. There's no defense involved. I spoke to Brian yeah. McLeod the other and he was saying, oh God, yeah, I remember that night.
Yes. I mean, those nights were very debauched. As I recall,
they were very debauched. There was a lot of tequila.
Do you want to take us through that? Explain it, where it was, Cheryl, and what the vibe was like.
Okay, so, it was in Pasadena. And so let me explain, too, how this whole thing came about. So I made a record, a very expensive record, with the
with
wonderful,
someone we've had on.
Incredible yeah. Hugh Padgham. And But I went into the record label and said, I feel like this isn't, I mean, it's very beautiful and slick, and I don't feel like that's, it's not going to serve me very well because I'm sort of raw around the edges. And anyway, cut to, I wind up playing keyboards in Toy Matinee, the touring version.
Because Pat Leonard and Kevin Gilbert, who are the two, but they had sort of fallen out at this point, right?
I had no idea what was going on. And Pat Leonard didn't want to tour. He wanted to stay home and produce. And so anyway, a band was put together and I was the keyboard player in it. And I wound up being very good friends. In fact, dating Kevin Gilbert, who introduced me to Bill Bottrell. He and Bill decided, let's put together a jam session. They had one. They invited me to the second one. It was called the Tuesday Night Music Club. And it was David Berwald and David Schwartz of David and David. It was Kevin Gilbert, Toy Matinee. It was Brian McLeod, who is still my favorite drummer of all time. I mean, crazy. Yeah.
The first guy to go back to being Ringo in the 80s. He was the first
yes.
guy I thought to
yeah,
get
yeah,
to that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He definitely was. His feel yeah. was impeccable and his choices were very Ringo.
Yeah.
All that to say, he was in a band called Wire Train, had played, obviously, on Toy Matinee. And so it was us group of guys and Bill Bottrell. I don't think I'm leaving anybody out. Okay,
no,
yeah.
No, that's all. That's the
so I got invited to the first one. I was the only girl there. And then I got invited to the second one. The first one, I think, rendered Leaving Las Vegas, maybe, or I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, and then after sort of a few of those jam sessions, which revolved around hanging out really late at night, going out to the Olive, talking conspiracy theories, drinking a ton and jamming, very literati, very all of us misfits, all of us misunderstood. We're so talented. How can we not be famous? But we wouldn't want to be famous, talented. Then Bill decided I'm going to produce this girl. And then he sort of started managing, the sessions, but it all started and culminated from these crazy, very debauched jam sessions.
Do you mind, sir? I don't know if you mind me saying, but like, don't worry. I have no idea where the cassette is in the box, but during this period, you actually sang a demo for me of a song I wrote with Kevin for a Japanese girl group. Called Make Some Time For Me. You did all the little Michael Jackson noises because you were doing those for Michael on stage, weren't you? You actually did all that.
Yes, I was. I was doing a lot of deviling and but I don't remember that. Fantastic. I'm shocked. I can't believe we didn't put that in the documentary.
I'm really not shocked it didn't go in the documentary. I can't even find the cassette. It was a very funny thing. It was me and Kevin trying to be Scritti Politti.
What I love about that first album and what I love about the who you were was, you know, a lot of backing singers, people who have done, you know, singing for other people on stage, you know, that 20 feet from stardom or whatever it is, they have a particular voice. And it tends to be full-blooded. And we've heard it a lot. But what the person you were on that album and have been since, was speaking to us through your voice. It didn't have a formality about it. It was character-driven. It had no reverb on it. It didn't have any of those effects, those posh effects that you need. Is that something you were conscious of happening at the time with Bill?
Well, Bill was very conscious of that. I mean, and also Bill had a very distinct, which guy I know you know, a very distinct producing, but also engineering style. You know, he got a ton from working with Jeff Lynne and he was the one, I think, that really created the sonic environment, and so much of it was about the character. And
with Bill, it's almost like what things sound like is almost political. You know, your snare sound is a political statement. How much your reverb is a political statement, you know.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And not only that, he had a rule that if you could play something really well, you weren't allowed to play that.
The night I was on the Tuesday Night Music Club, I was playing pedal steel guitar.
Yes.
I had no idea how to play a pedal steel guitar.
Yes. I mean, he always made... I won't go into that. But anyway...
Let's talk about your voice.
You know, I learned so much from him. And I learned things that I have taken with me... along the way. I mean, I incorporate into recording my own records. You know, I'm constantly saying, okay, I love what you just played. Now set that down and go over to the piano, you know, that kind of thing. And also just his love of gear and sonics and doing exactly opposite of what your instinct is. They used to have this phrase that if it had been done before, that you are heading towards the vortex of mediocrity. Yeah. Do you remember them saying that? It's mediocre, you know.
That's a Bill thing to say.
It is. And even on the, you know, many years later, we worked together on another record called Detour.
It was lovely that happened.
I learned from him. He was so eccentric, but such an artist.
You know, one thing, another thing, obviously, that we see in the documentary, one thing that's really sad in the documentary is how this is a moment when all of you should be celebrating, you know, winning Grammys and having the success of this record, especially you. But one stupid moment on David Letterman seems to change everything. And when I watched that, I felt total sympathy with you because... You just make it, you know, if I'd be the same, we're an artist promoting. And David Letterman said, is Leaving Las Vegas autobiographical? And you say, yeah, kind of. Well, that's the best way it should be said, because that sells the records to people. And people got upset about that in the band. And it caused all kinds of terrible, terrible repercussions that obviously have no place in reality.
And in the documentary seems to obviously really still affect you, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it does still affect me. And I think mainly because it was my first foray into the betrayal of friendship. You know, these guys were my beloved friends. And Bill and I were super conscious about making sure whoever was in the room got an equal slice. And you know, everybody in that room was an artist. And at which point I needed to go out and promote it. Nobody wanted to be in a band in a van. because they'd all tour, they'd all had big careers. But at which point I did make it, it was like, well, we want to be the band. And I was like, I can't find my band. I mean, and then the David Letterman thing happened, and then John O'Brien.
John O'Brien, I can't see how you can.
Really, I mean,
awful situation.
Well, I mean, all that to say is that you know, they're going to be, no matter what you go through, they're going to be moments that are so profoundly disappointing that you pick yourself up and dust yourself off and move forward, or you don't. And those are the moments that sort of where the rubber meets the road. You either keep going or you don't. And it probably is a weed out in my business, how much stamina you have and how much belief you have in yourself as well, that you put yourself back out there again and again.
Well, talking about self-belief, because what's extraordinary is what you go and do, because that weird thing that I still can't quite figure out about how Bill comes to New Orleans and then just goes. And then, but the fact that you did that next album all on your own.
Yeah.
Complete. I mean, no, that's amazing. Produced, you know, with that fantastic engineer. And it's played. That's extraordinary.
Well, in Bill's defense, you know, I don't know what was going on in his personal life. And Bill, like I said, he's an artist like everybody else. And you don't know when someone's going through something, how they're going to handle it. We'd had a great evening, gone out and drunk a bunch. And the next thing, he was gone. So, and I look at every event and go, okay, if Bill had stayed, I would not have made that record. And if Bill had stayed, there would still be goo around the second record. And it was a moment where, okay, you're starting over. And here is this incredible and quirky and brilliant female engineer that you're going to work with. Mm-hmm. And you're going to pull in two friends. I mean, Brian McLeod. I can't speak highly enough about him. I couldn't use the bass player because me and Jeff wound up like doing the...
You're a pretty mean bass player yourself, it must be said.
I have my moments, but only because, you know, that it was a, hey, close the door, get in there in the basement, kids, and make music and have fun, and then decide later on what you're going to do with it. And that was really the attitude.
But that's Jeff Trott you're talking about, right?
If we look at...
You're talking about Jeff Trott, who's been a real key player in your career, hasn't he?
Oh, he's my musical husband. He's my other... You know, he's my Keith.
Yeah.
But even, sorry, Cheryl, just say, look at the point we've got to in your story. It's quite extraordinary. There's the Michael Jackson thing, this huge thing, which has ended really horribly. That could have ended a lot of people. You've then gone and been given that amazing thing of a massive, posh, Hugh Patton produced record, which you've said no to. You've then started the whole thing, the Tuesday Night Music Club, which you finally get your success. And then everything falls apart, and then you're left alone to make an album. I mean, this is amazing. You're battling odds all the way.
And, you know, and that being said, only a documentary would make me actually go back and live everything sequentially and try to understand it. And it's a weird thing doing a documentary. It is liberating, telling the story in my own terms, but... I didn't expect that it was going to be, I mean, I still get really emotional even talking about it, which I'll try to spare you guys. But yeah, there was a lot.
It's a very emotional, it's an emotional ride because one finds, obviously, you know, I'm a huge fan and I have very fond memories of you, but you're a very easy person to get invested in. I think that's a lot of your, you know, because there's a truth and a sort of realness about you. So I think people will find the documentary emotional.
But also I think something else you're battling against, Cheryl, or battled against, certainly then, was that when a guy goes out and just, you know, makes records and thinks only of his career, that's fine. He's a successful guy. When a woman does it, they're driven. And that is, there's something critical about that word, isn't there? That the implication is that she's a bit of a hard bitch and she's going to, you know, no matter... And that's again, it's another part of the sexist business that you're having to fight.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's that ambition thing. When a man is ambitious, it's very, that's a good trait. When a woman is ambitious, she's a bitch, you know, and I mean, that's one of the reasons that in America, we don't have a female president. It's like, we have this problem, you know, with, well, she's too ambitious. She's not likable. Well, we're inching forward, but good grief. It's like enough already. And that has been something that, that I certainly have suffered throughout all of my career. I mean, like being called a perfectionist is like such a dig, when really it's something to sort of aspire to. You want things to be the best they can be while still maintaining authenticity and, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a weird business.
There's a moment in the film when we see you struggling with not knowing what you should be writing your lyrics about. Your lyrics are so brilliant, but they tell stories about you and about experience. And then you come up against a situation which a lot of artists, when all of your experience is simply the music business, and that was a tough time for you, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I think everything culminated around the fact that I was getting ready to turn 40, and everything on the radio was like Britney Spears, like these 17-year-olds. And I'm also competing with the fact that I've had all these hits, and who am I now? And what am I going to write about? I've only been on the road for the last 15 or 12 years. And also putting that pressure on myself that, okay, I can't take time off until I get this record done. And yet what I really needed was time off to live, so I'd have something to write about. And it happens to every artist. I mean, that's when those records get made that people go, oh, they're rich and famous now and they have nothing to say. And, you know, $1.5 million goes into making a record that you're just like, I cannot figure out how to finish this thing. You know, ultimately some really good things came out of that record, you know, Suck Up the Sun, obviously. And I mean, there were some big hits on it, but it was a record that was sorely crafted. And I mean that in a derogatory sense, and that, yeah, you do learn how to craft songs along the way. You learn how to write a good song, but are those songs the songs that you feel define who you are? And you know, the one thing that came out of that period was, I think I wound up being, you know, having to get help for some, you know, real depression. I wound up going into Mount Sinai. And what I came out of it with was the Weather Channel, which was sort of the ender of that record.
Yeah, which fantastic. Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, that record has good moments on it. But to me, the most authentic and maybe only authentic moment on that record was a song I didn't remember writing at all.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. Because you do have you have this great ability. You write that universal hook, right? You write that thing that goes out, speaks to everybody. It's a wonderful, catchy thing and speaks to everyone. And is that part of your crafting, or is that like a stop? Or do those things fall out for you? Do you know what I mean? Sometimes when things just fall out of the guitar, or do you think, there it is?
Well, I have my ways of writing, which come natural to me. I'm always, I think because I grew up on the Beatles, I grew up on the Rolling Stones. I mean, they were masterful at tricking you into thinking that song was easy to write. You know, they could write something that felt like it was simple, and yet you could never write it in a million years. You know, like a song like Let It Be or Yesterday or Can't Get No Satisfaction, or, I mean, epic. And I think I just always have gravitated to the hook and then written the song around it. So, you know, there have been those songs along the way, though. And I think every artist will attest to that. You write that, you go, I have no idea where that came from. That's not even a style I write. And those are the ones that make you want to keep going. You know, the ones where you got out of your egoic headspace and something jumped through, you know.
But I've not been able to get If It Makes You Happy out of my head all day since listening to it this morning, you know, when that big euphoric chorus.
Okay, I'm going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb and just tell the truth about that song, which I have before. But Jeff Trott walked in with that epic line. I would love to totally take credit for that, but it's one of those brilliant moments when he walked in with the line, the melody and everything. And I said, oh my God, That is completely perfect for illustrating where I'm at right now in this moment in time. You know, just synchronous.
So and universal. Everyone has
and universal.
That, yeah,
but it has that classic country twist, doesn't it? If it makes you happy, you know, why are you so sad? Or if it has that kind of country thing
Keith Richards. I don't know how many times I've seen them play, and when he goes up to do his sets, his songs in the set, he'll always say something on the mic like, "I'm happy to be here," and then he'll finish it with, "I'm happy to be anywhere." You know, it's like anywhere, one of those lines that's like,
yeah.
It's so cheeky, but yeah, it's kind of true.
Your duet with him, oh my God!
Yeah, I worship that man.
What a great weekend! We've just had for septuagenarians and octogenarians. I mean, we played on stage with Nick at a big open air concert. Rolling Stones played in Hyde Park.
The same night.
Paul played at Glastonbury. Yeah.
I mean, it gives me hope. I mean, I don't know, with the exception of Stevie Nicks, I don't know many women that are still doing it and that people are coming to see. And it gives me great hope. And I saw the Rolling Stones here with Steve Jordan, who I felt like really honored Charlie, honored the legacy of the Rolling Stones. But they were incredible. I mean, why should they not be? And Sir Paul, who I know just played Glastonbury at 80, did 38 songs. That makes me want to go take a nap right now.
We have to listen. I've got Nick Mason playing. We got him playing Astronomy Domini every night, like a wild dervish.
It
is what keeps us young. Keeps us going.
You spoke earlier about making records that surprise you and aren't necessarily feel like they're in your genre. And I wonder what you thought about that, because, you've won awards for pop act, for rock act, for country act. And some of those things are quite, entrenched in their tribes, aren't they? Country's over here, and that sort of amorphic Sheryl Crow, is that something that you like to be?
I don't really think about it. I mean, for me, one of the things that I loved about the Rolling Stones when I was a kid was that on my little hometown radio stations, all they played was like old country, and I really didn't like it. And suddenly, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, those records, they brought the thing that I didn't love, but that I knew so well, and it was part of my fiber, and made it rock. And so I look at music and I go, okay, I can't even recognize country now, because country in the new country sounds like 80s pop. And pop music sounds like Top Line and Groove. It's just like, so at a certain point, genres seem kind of ridiculous. It just winds up being music. But I've always gravitated to the country feel with the rock feel, with the Memphis feel, and it just winds up being music, All the categories of the Grammys, I did a couple of years ago, I made the Threads record, and I love that record so much. And it was an authentic experience to collaborate. And of course, it didn't get nominated for a Grammy, which was totally fine, because for me, the award and the joy and the reward of it was getting to work with my heroes. I remember somebody saying to me, it should have been nominated for a Grammy. And I was like, you know what? Instead, they need to, as well as best new artist, they need to give an award for best old artist. just like...
Your middle ground.
Nick Mason.
They're still out there writing music.
When we started this band, Nick said his dream was to simultaneously win a lifetime achievement and best newcomer.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Let's talk about Threads, because it is such a stellar... It must have been... This is everyone you talk about growing up listening to. And everyone is on your record.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, because as a school teacher in St. Louis, I went and saw Hail Hell Rock and Roll. They were filming it in St. Louis, and there's Steve Jordan and Keith Richards and, of course, Chuck Berry. And I was just a school teacher. And then cut to 30 years later, I'm in the studio with Keith, and Steve Jordan is producing. And you can't you can't envision those things. You can't, like, as a 20-year-old go, okay, in 30 years, I'm going to be in the studio with those guys that I'm watching right now.
And James Taylor, and Stevie Nicks, and...
Yes, yeah, and to not, you know, to have loved and idolized them, but then to get to work with them, working with Stevie in the studio. And to me, the Threads record was the result of my working with Chris Christopherson, who was starting to lose the ability to make memories. And I realized, gosh, these are my heroes, and we're in the phase now.
Yeah, one of my
where we're all getting old.
One of my favorite duets ever. If you, I don't know whether you've seen it. It's where he sings with Rita Coolidge on Old Grey Whistle Test.
We watched. It's on the Old Grey Whistle Test. We watched this over and over on the bus. It's one of the most intimate kind of erotically charged, if you like, duets ever. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Yeah, if you can find it.
Well, you know, he's a sexy dude.
You know what? There's a bit in the film where you're on stage at a festival in America, and you see the audience of young kids singing one of your early songs. I can't remember which one. If It Makes You Happy, maybe. I can't remember which one it was.
Oh, If It Makes You Happy.
And
yeah.
And what occurred to me is, because there was also this conversation you were having about worrying about relating to younger people as we get older. And it occurred to me that what actually happens is you make these records and that younger you will sing to younger people forever. And as you get older, that 30-year-old you will sing to 30-year-olds forever. And that's that. That will always be relevant. But right now, I guess, you are writing more for people that have lived lives. Do you feel that?
I am, but I mean, I love that idea because, you know, you don't feel like your age. I remember my grandmother telling me that when she got old, she would wash dishes and she'd look down and go, oh my gosh, whose hands are those? Because you don't feel like the person with the wrinkly hands, you know? And unless you look in the mirror, you don't feel like the age that you are. I know you guys can relate to that. We feel youthful and we feel still inspired and still, I mean, I still practice. I still get off.
Oh, steady, steady.
I know. Well, you know, the pandemic was amazing because my kids would be like, Mom, why are you playing the guitar? And I'd be like, because I like it. I enjoy it. You know, it's not something that you have the luxury of doing when you're always out on the road or whatever. But, but yeah, you know, I find myself now, I do write from the standpoint of who I am now, but even the song Forever, which I wrote about my kid and what he's experiencing and the stress and the anxiety of being alive now, that we do have to remember that every single moment is, it's a precious gift. And that, I mean, as woo woo and as greeting card as it sounds, we have to remember that every moment we spend like this is a moment we can't get back, and that's all that matters. And, you know, will that relate to a 13-year-old? Maybe not right now, but will it matter when you're 25? Maybe, you know, you never know.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the phone nonstop and not, you know, when I was 11, I got given a guitar. And I just
we're as bad.
All
we're
my
as bad.
All my time writing on it, you know, that's what I did. You know, it
was, yeah.
In fact, right now I want to reach over you and pull that J200 off the wall. I can see in your fabulous studio.
Okay, Emmy Lou Harris gave me that guitar. I'm just gonna say it. Emmy Lou Harris. Gave me that guitar. Yeah,
that's not helping. That's not
I'm
helping.
Sorry. I'm very sorry.
That's beautiful.
Take a moment, breathe it in.
I know, because you have a fabulous collection of vintage amps and guitars and stuff, don't you? A lot of tellies.
Yeah, I will tell you that.
I've got great envy looking at your studio.
Underneath all the hair and the fake eyelashes is a total music nerd and gear geek.
Cheryl, we've kept you for an hour, and I know that you're on a really tight regime, and you're talking to lots of people promoting this film. I just want to say that I think this is one of the great rock documentaries. We absolutely loved it, and that anyone who gets a chance to see it should go out and see it and buy the record as well, because you've done some new tracks for the record, for the soundtrack, haven't you?
Yes, yeah. In fact, we cut Live With Me, which was the first thing I got to sing with the Rolling Stones, and Mick played on it. I texted him and said, hey, we're cutting Live With Me for the documentary, and would you play some harp on it? He's like, yeah, send it over. And I mean, that's the kind of thing, like, I went, you know, you're still that 14-year-old girl who's zipping and unzipping sticky fingers, you know, and
yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, good luck. Crazy.
Good luck with everything. Thank you so much for doing our show.
Thank you. And it's great to see you guys.
It's so nice to see you, Cheryl. Really
it's
nice
to see you.
See you
guys.
Lovely to have
I
that tiny
you,
little... I love you. And it's so nice to be a tiny, tiny little nugget right back in, at some point in your story.
Well, you definitely are. You definitely are. You've inspired me. I mean, your bass playing is ridiculous.
And good luck with the tour, because the tour's about to start. The tour's about to start, right?
Yeah, we're finishing the summer tour, and then I'm getting ready to work on a one-woman show. But hopefully we're going to be...
Is that going to be storytelling? Is that going to be storytelling and that sort of thing?
Yeah,
I've done that. I've done that. If you want any help with that, I've done that.
Hey, look, guy, Bruce Springsteen done it. Bruce Springsteen will give her help. Right?
It's tricky when you say it's tricky when you say one woman show plus a guy. guy. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying I want to be in it. I'm just saying if you want any tips.
Yeah. Okay, I will be calling you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, guys.
I am grinning like a Cheshire cat here.
Yeah, she's lovely, isn't she? I mean, I'm just totally in awe of her talent. I mean, her chops in the film, in the documentary, you know, going from one instrument to the next, bass, guitar, and whirly and piano. I mean,
and keyboards, the keyboard playing, which is something we haven't really seen before. Her keyboard playing is fantastic.
Well, she was a music teacher. That's how that was her first job coming out of school. What I like about Cheryl is there's nothing. She's still so enthusiastic and so in love with the business, and you really got that sense from her.
Yeah.
She's not battered by it to the extent that she's, you know, cynical now, like we are.
And could be. It was interesting, you know, pointing that journey. You could be a real hardened artist. As Keith says, she's very strong, you know.
Yeah, because Keith's in the video talking about it. Yeah. The film. I'm so glad we made it through the traffic, over the motorways. Our coach had an accident.
And let's just say, we actually left Geneva early, especially, just so we could get here.
Yeah, but don't you remember?
We need to thank the band. We need to thank the rest of the band for doing that for us.
But our coach was caught in an accident right at the beginning, and we had a policeman come along, and the driver's having to give...
We had policemen and everything. And then we had a truck pull across us and hit us, and we had to stop, and luckily that was de-escalated. All sorts.
All things we go through for
you. Oh, dear listener, if you only knew what we go through to bring you your weekly
anyway, we're still,
morsel.
We've still got two more in the diary before we finish the tour, haven't we? I think so.
We have,
Rock and Tours continues. Thank you so much to Ben and to Stu and to Ian and all who produced this show. And we will be back next week.
We will. So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.